The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a jolly, merry, happy, joyful, fantastic, exciting, fancy, magnificent, remarkable, special, white, sparkling, terrific, stunning, festive, and wonderful holiday season.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, oceans of clean energy on humanity's doorstep, like salt gradient energy.
It's salinity gradient, so it takes the difference between salt water and fresh water. And you know that two cups of water, one salt, one fresh, and you put them together, it automatically mixes. If you put membranes in between that are ion selective, you can actually force the positive and the negatively charged ions to go only in one direction, while the water still mixes. You can build a power source like that. You generate electricity.
Tipping points in Earth systems, unstable states world governments need to prepare for now.
We have a phenomenon that is rare, that is relatively fast, that cannot be stopped once it's started, and that leads to a fundamental change in the nature of the system we're thinking about. And once you start thinking about these currently stable conditions flipping to alternative states, that becomes very, very worrying.
And America's passionate attachments to Israel, loyalty is a must.
Reconfirm what your commitment is on Israel.
I strongly support Israel.
Do you think the nation of Israel has committed war crime?
No. But no, I do not.
The lack of signature by you runs chills up my spine.
My unequivocal support of Israel over the years. There's been no flip-flop on that.
Do you intend to maintain this close relationship?
I have always said I am a supporter of Israel. I've never voted against Israel ever in the 12 years I was...
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. The world's largest source of untapped energy. What comes to mind? Remaining oil and gas reserves? How about clean wind and solar? In fact, it's the world's oceans. Huge volumes of energy are stored in ocean waves, tides, and surface heat. Then there's salt gradient energy. Wherever fresh river water flows into salty seas, salt ions can be directed across a stack of plastic membranes, generating electricity. Salinity gradient, or blue energy it's called. Here's a story about that. I'm sitting in a tour bus, heading north along the long dike connecting the provinces of Holland and Friesland, the Afsluit dike it's called, to the northwest, the Waddensee, a branch of the salty North Sea, to the southeast, the freshwater IJsselmeer. Our guide points out a large array of wind turbines, a common sight here in the Netherlands.
There's 90 turbines here. Each turbine is 4.3 megawatts.
Wind Park Friesland is the world's largest wind park in the middle of a lake. It generates enough electricity to power a 500,000 Dutch households.
So in front of us, I can already see the Redstedt plant, and it's a blue metal building on the right-hand side, very near the roadside.
Straight ahead, our guide points to a more unusual, less visible source of clean electricity. In the middle of the Afsluit dike, fresh and salt water are pumped through a stack of plastic membranes. Salt gradient energy, it's called.
Welcome at Redstack, at our pilot facility.
Redstack is the first operating facility of this sort in the world. RED stands for reverse electrodialysis. Michael van Ostrom tells us how it works.
It's salinity gradient, so it takes the difference between salt water and fresh water. And you know that two cups of water, one salt, one fresh, and you put them together, it automatically mixes. If you put membranes in between that are ion selective, you can actually force the positive and the negatively charged ions to go only in one direction, while the water still mixes. But you can build a power source like that. So put a load on it, and then you generate electricity.
Redstack's pilot plant generates 1 kilowatt of electricity. Not much, but scaling up will be easy. having proved it works, the next step will be to build larger membrane stacks. A 2-megawatt demonstration facility could be up and running in a couple of years, enough to power about 10,000 homes. Reverse electrodialysis is probably the most unusual way to tap Earth's largest source of clean energy, its oceans. By 2050, ocean waves, tides, coastal currents, surface heat, and salt could supply 10% of Europe's electricity needs, experts say, cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 234 million tons. Global estimates are similar.
The second industrial revolution, scaling up wave and tidal manufacturing, will start in our studio after the keynotes.
In late October, hundreds of developers gathered in The Hague to show off their devices. Unlike wind and solar, ocean energy technologies have yet to be narrowed down to the very best. There's lots of variety.
Yes, so I'm Alejandro Marquez, and I'm the CEO of Magallanes Renovables. We are a tidal energy company.
And this is your device. This is like a boat with a tidal turbine beneath it.
Basically, yes. As the current passes by, the current moves the rotors, same as a wind would move a windmill. The rated capacity is 1.5 megawatts. So this is enough energy to power around 1,500 homes. The idea is to install many of them to create a farm of tidal energy devices.
I check out more ocean energy devices.
Hello, yes. My name is Eunice Silva, and I'm a technical project manager at Core Power Ocean.
How does this thing work?
So the device is a technology that it's called a point absorber type of wave energy converter, which means that it's moored to the seabed, it's stuck to the seafloor, and then it moves up and down as the wave passes through the converter. So this means that it will transform this up and down motion into rotational motion that it then produces electricity.
My name is Juan, and I am a representative for EcoWave Dynamis. We are a Greek-based company. Our system is a wave energy converter that follows the basics of the gyroscope, meaning that you are going to harvest energy from all the possible directions, regardless of the direction of the waves, and you can just plug a generator and you will have directly energy.
There's all sorts of ways to harvest ocean energy, and that energy is begging to be harvested. Unlike winds, which come and go, and the sun that goes down every night, the ocean is always in motion. It also has an energy density 800 times greater than wind. Wave tidal energy costs more than wind and solar today, but not by much, and prices will come down. Remy Gruet is CEO of Ocean Energy Europe.
I don't know what price competitive for the consumer means, because every single technology that is not renewable is being subsidized in Europe at the moment. Nuclear is being subsidized, coal is being subsidized, gas is being subsidized. Now, are we talking unsubsidized competition? Then we can talk. You want to talk competitivity with oil and with gas and coal? Well, it depends. Do you integrate the cost of CO2? Because if you do, again, tidal is going to be cost competitive with these two technologies, including CO2 cost, very, very quickly. And wave is roughly about 5 years, maybe technologically behind wave in terms of behind tidal in terms of development. So, but they will get there as well. And what we also know is that we can't burn coal or gas by 2050 anymore. They need to be off the grid, so they need to go.
Several dozen energy developers pile into a bus for a drive up to North Holland to see ocean energy devices in action. First stop, the North Sea port of Den Helder.
This is the turbine. Actually, only this top part is the turbine. This is the generator. Yeah? Links on. Okay, links on to the left.
Fred Gardner is the founder of Symphony Wave Power. His wave energy converter will soon be bobbing up and down in the North Sea. What's the difference between a North Sea wave and an ocean wave?
Ocean waves have a very long distance to develop. North Sea waves is just wind waves. They develop on 300, 400, 500 kilometer distance, and they're much shorter.
So why do you prefer to put your wave converter in the North Sea versus in the ocean?
Well, the energy is more or less, but your device can be is much more efficient. So your device goes up much faster, and any power you take out is velocity times force. So you can take with a small device, you can get more energy out.
Fred Gardner's device should be harvesting energy from North Sea swells by the end of next year, delivering 25 kilowatts of electricity to the Dutch grid, if all goes well, by 2025. Another handful will be bobbing alongside, enough to power about 100 homes, proving that the system works. No one will be happier than the oil and gas workers who've helped build Fred Gardner's device. There are lots of them here in the port of Den Helder, building a device that survives North Sea conditions, generating clean electricity. Is it something they enjoy?
Everyone that's working here knows about the project, and they love that they are not just working on oil and gas and fossil fuels, that they work on renewables. That increases their motivation to work on these kind of projects.
Does it?
Yes, yes. You can ask the people. They all love the project.
What do they love about it?
Well, that you're working on the future, that you're providing us with clean energy.
A half-hour drive from Den Helder, in the middle of the Afsluit Dike, Rick Sieber shows how clean electricity can be generated from water in a completely different way.
We take the water from this and from that side and go to the stacks. And this is the heart. When you follow me, please.
Rick leads visitors to Redstack's membrane module.
This is the heart of the installation. You see here a stack with about 500 cell pairs. The energy that we gain, we bring it to the grid, to the public grid.
Generating electricity by combining fresh and salt water? It seems odd. Seeing is believing.
Any volunteer for making blue energy?
Sieber leads us to a small installation, something out of a high school science lab. Two bottles of water, one fresh, one salty, draining into tubes leading to a membrane wired up to a voltage device and a tiny propeller. Rick turns the valves. Everyone holds their breath. It takes a few seconds for voltage to build. The propeller resists a bit, so Rick gives it a gentle poke, to everyone's delight.
You will see that this one will go.
Now, the tiny propeller turns by itself. Quickly, everyone's impressed.
Is the right plug? Well,
I have lied to you.
You just made blue energy.
This is so great.
Congratulations.
Just a couple of watts of blue energy. Sometime next year, Redstack plans to send 16 kilowatts into the Dutch grid. With financing in place, a 2-megawatt plant will follow its 2030 target, 150 megawatts. That'd be enough to power 750,000 Dutch homes. According to experts, salinity gradient energy could supply 10% of Dutch electricity demand by 2050. The greatest potential is at the mouth of the Rhine and Maas rivers, where vast volumes of fresh water flow into the salty North Sea. Wave and tidal could add another 5% to the ocean energy mix. Much less visible than the Netherlands' famous wind turbines, providing clean, continuous electricity day and night, 24/7. For more information about wave, tidal, and salt gradient energy, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Human emission of CO2 and other greenhouse gases has warmed Earth's surface temperature by about 1.1 degrees relative to the late 19th century at a rate of about 0.3 of a degree per decade since 1980. That rate is steadily rising. As Earth's surface warms, thermal expansion and melting ice sheets have raised sea levels by 0.2 of a meter. That rate is rising too. Slow and steady? For now. In a recent report, a team of scientists warn about tipping points. These are inflection points where Earth warming and the destruction of Earth's living fabric become non-linear and unstoppable, and where Earth systems start shifting to new, potentially dangerous states. 25 tipping points have been identified. 5 major ones may already have been transgressed. More may soon be tripped, triggering a cascade of amplifying feedbacks across Earth's interlocked climate system and biosphere. Globalized human economies and societies will inevitably suffer. As if all this weren't scary enough, there is no adequate global governance at the scale of the threats posed by negative tipping points, the report's authors warn. Manjana Milkerit is one of them. Milkerit is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Oslo and lead author of a chapter of the report about tipping point governance. I reached Manjana Milkerit in Oslo. What are tipping points?
Tipping points are specific features of what we call complex systems. The way we are using them in the report, especially when we're referring to climate tipping points or Earth system tipping points, we refer to the fact that the Earth system has major subcomponents that have what's called multiple stable states, so they can exist in varied constellations or configurations, and that under certain circumstances, they can move rather rapidly and irreversibly for a certain time period from one stable state to another. So that's not a very frequent occurrence, but it is possible that it happens. And then if the conditions are right, a small change in that system can trigger what we call self-sustaining feedback mechanism. So the change process keeps propelling itself forward. That creates nonlinearity, rapid change towards the second alternative stable state. And so we have a phenomenon that is rare, that is relatively fast, that cannot be stopped once it's started, and that leads to a fundamental change in the nature of the system we're thinking about. So, for example, if you think about the Amazon rainforest, that one can change from being in its current, for a very long time, stable rainforest state towards a much drier and very different grassland kind of state. So that would be characterized by very different plant and animal life. That would be characterized by very different hydrology and possibility for living. So these are just very different, what we call system states. That kind of flip from one state to another is possible for all the systems that we try to characterize in this report, whether it's ice sheets or ocean currents or seagrass meadows or glaciers and so forth.
And there have been 25 different tipping points identified. Some are associated with the cryosphere, with the icy surface of planet Earth, others with the biosphere, and others with ocean atmosphere circulatory patterns. Can you quickly review some of these?
So we said more than 25, I think specifically 26 different candidates for tipping processes have been identified. The report assesses many more systems and even shows us how confident we are in whether or not some of these are not tipping elements or cannot have this kind of nonlinear behavior. But yeah, so I think the key distinction here is, as you said, between cryosphere, biosphere, and kind of ocean atmosphere circulation systems. The cryosphere, we have major ice sheets and glaciers. Also, permafrost is a component of the cryosphere. So we know that our major ice sheets can undergo these nonlinear transitions between their ice sheet stage, which has been the reality on planet Earth for hundreds of thousands or millions of years, and they can go to a non-existing ice sheet state. Of course, that transition might also take a very long time, but relative to the existence of the ice sheet, that is a short period if it happens within 2,000 or 3,000 years, for example. So the ice sheets can undergo that kind of transition. Then we have in the biosphere key examples. I've given you one already, the Amazon rainforest could die back and no longer be a rainforest. We also have other forests, the boreal forests in the northern latitudes of the world. We have another important biome that's at risk already today, and that's the coral reefs in the warm water areas of around the world. And then the third major system, which is the ocean atmosphere circulation systems, there we have things like the Atlantic overturning circulation, abbreviated as the AMOC, that has been of concern. Also some more recent, recently added systems like the North Atlantic subpolar gyre. And then in the atmosphere, we have monsoon systems that could undergo such tipping processes.
And these systems are coupled so that if, in theory, if we exceed one tipping point, if we pass one tipping point, we enter into this cascading process where other tipping points get engaged. And all these kinds of effects cascade through not just the climate system and the living world, but through human societies and global economies.
That's right. So there's two things to distinguish, I think, and it goes back to what we started with, the fact that we're talking about systems and things are connected. So these different components of the Earth system are connected to each other in important ways, and we're still studying which ones are linked to which ones and how they influence each other. Sometimes they can have stabilizing effects on each other, but sometimes they can also, as you said, increase the risk of triggering one another. So those connections between different Earth system tipping systems are being studied in terms of cascading potentials. But then we also have the connection between these Earth systems or natural systems and human societies, and there are multiple connections, lots of them. These environmental systems provide the conditions, and currently still stable conditions, for human life, for everything we do, for how we breathe, what kinds of food we can produce, where water is available, what kinds of materials we have available to construct our settlements, where we live, actually all of our social conditions for life, how we feed ourselves, how we clothe ourselves, what we do is conditioned by the environment. And once you start thinking about these currently stable conditions flipping to alternative states, that becomes very, very worrying. So there are lots of different kinds of impacts that we anticipate from these change processes, and these impacts differ significantly depending on the tipping point or the tipping system we're thinking about. So for example, impacts would be very different from the die-off of the coral reefs compared to the melting of ice sheets or the release of the permafrost. So different impacts are expected, but they all would be severe and possibly destabilizing for society. So we also look into the potential of accelerating change or negative social tipping points as a consequence of Earth system tipping points.
And one of the repercussions that you talk about in your paper is the collapse of world food production, in wheat production and in grain production.
So we point out that, for example, the collapse of the AMOC would significantly alter temperature and moisture availability in certain grain-producing areas of the world, and that could be global scale significance.
And the AMOC is the Atlantic?
That's the Atlantic overturning circulation, right? One of these ocean major ocean circulation patterns that regulate temperature and moisture and storm patterns and so forth around the Atlantic. So yes, we point out that could have significant consequences for the ability to grow major staple crops around the world. That's just one example of how the impacts of these tipping processes are really severe and need to be considered at this point by our global decision makers to make sure we try to prevent them. This is really our key strategy, should be the prevention of passing these tipping points, because their impacts could be so significant, diverse, and around the world. One challenge that we have, of course, with these tipping processes is to distinguish to what extent are these impacts different from the general and well-understood impacts of climate change. We do know that tipping points can contribute to accelerating climate change itself by, for example, additional release of greenhouse gases. We're accelerating warming with some of these tipping processes. But tipping processes do have their own distinct set of impacts that differ from the well-understood impacts of climate change. And that's one reason, for example, why we are pointing to the fact that our existing governance frameworks for adaptation, for example, or for loss and damage need to be revisited and rethought in the context of our knowledge about tipping points. So we need to reassess our vulnerabilities, the exposure to tipping point impacts in different places around the world to make sure we are prepared for these impacts or potential impacts, because we're hoping that we can still prevent these processes from happening. But to the extent that they do come to pass, we need to be prepared. We need to increase the resilience of our societies, adjust our systems accordingly, and then deal with those consequences. And that might, as I said, require different approaches than we currently have in place, because these current plans and frameworks do not consider the specific risks of tipping points.
But you write in your report, currently there is no adequate global governance at the scale of the threats posed by negative tipping points. There is no adequate global governance.
That's right. So currently we have a lot of institutions in the world that address climate change and other sustainability issues, but they're all designed without actually considering specifically the risks of these nonlinear large-scale tipping processes. That I would suggest really require a different kind of logic, or in many cases now adjustment of these existing institutions to account for these additional threats that are at a scale we haven't faced before. And so the institutions we have, for example, the UNFCCC, are all attempting to address the threat of climate change. And every instrument we have in that toolbox, from trying to address mitigation, so reducing greenhouse gases, to adaptation, to loss and damage, to finance, all of these need to be revisited and in many ways strengthened to address these increasing risks of tipping points. And that starts with the reconsideration of the global temperature goal. So our current global temperature goal says that we want to stay well below 2 degrees Celsius and have an aspirational additional goal to make efforts towards 1.5 degrees. But our report says we're already at this current level of warming at risk of triggering 5 tipping points. So 5 tipping points already are, or tipping elements, are in a state where they could be triggered at any moment. Maybe the chance isn't that high yet, but the chance of triggering those will increase significantly once we surpass 1.5 degrees of global warming. So this is really where we're increasing the risks for these severe global scale changes with potential cascading effects. And so we're arguing strongly that 1.5 needs to be the only viable temperature goal left. We might even have to aim lower than that if we truly want to minimize the risks of passing tipping points ultimately. And we are very soon about to surpass the 1.5 degrees of warming, maybe within the 2030s. And so it really becomes imperative to rethink the mitigation pathways that allow us to draw temperatures back down to or even below 1.5 degrees. So we need to start thinking about minimizing peak temperature, minimizing the overshoot period above 1.5 degrees, and drawing temperatures back down with carbon removal technologies.
Well, the term global governance seems to me to be an oxymoron. I mean, looking at the way the international community has dealt with the Russia-Ukraine crisis and the inability of the Security Council to just agree on a ceasefire in Gaza, it seems that global governance is it's almost like a contradiction in terms. Governments are, the most powerful ones are competitive, acquisitive. They seek power and money. There is no rule of law. There's rule of law for official enemies and not for our friends. And global governance seems to me to be anything but cooperative. The way governance works today in the world seems to me to be antithetical to what's required to actually, look after Earth systems.
So, of course, the starting point for any efforts to address global challenges, whether that's in the domain of conflict, international conflict between states, or in the domain of the environment, like we're looking at right now, the climate or Earth system tipping points are often placed within this domain of environmental issues, starts from, internationally at least, from a place where we have a system of sovereign states, where every state is not bound by law like we are in national contexts. They're sovereign. They get to do within their territory, at least, what they want. And then we have developed over time systems of international relations, international institutions to address or at least try to address some of the problems that occur in such a system of independent countries. And that, of course, in terms of conflict, that often is a domain where resolution is the